Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. We are joined today by the Welsh journalist, documentary filmmaker, screenwriter and best-selling author John Ronson. He's written 9 books, including Then, Adventures with Extremists, The Psychopath Test, as well as his most recent work, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, an exploration of public shaming, in particular via social media outlets such as Twitter. And this is going to be the topic of our discussion today. It's a book full of humour, but I also found it very compassionate, wise, and as we'll see as our conversation unfolds, somewhat brave too. Anyway, hello, John. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Hi, Barry. It's nice to talk to you. I was just on your website and was happy to see that you see the world the same way I do.
Brilliant. Okay, well, yeah. Well, let's get started then. So what was it that prompted you to write the book, John?
I mean, it was a kind of dawning realization that the world was getting much more polemical and, you know, hitherto, the kind of people I could usually count on to be sort of rational and liberal and humanistic were becoming less so, and were beginning to remind me of the kind of people I used to write about in my previous books. You know, people who were sort of lurching towards extreme polemical thought. And you know, I was one of those people too in the early days. And it's because I was so in love with, you know, this, what I wrongly saw as a kind of new form of democracy, which was social media. So I remember, like, a few friends of mine, the comedy writer Graham Linehan, and the at the time she was a kind of skeptic podcaster Rebecca Watson, at the same time both said to me, you've got to get on this thing called Twitter. You know, it had just started, and they were saying, I remember very clearly Graham Linehan saying to me, if the internet is black magic, Twitter is white magic. You know, it was a place where people were being kind and unselfconscious and were just, yeah, unselfconscious, you know, and compassionate, and would admit things about themselves that they wouldn't, you know, that they would have been too ashamed or embarrassed to admit. And they were doing it on Twitter. It was like this incredible new community. And I joined it and loved it. And then, you know, out of that, I think, grew this desire to shame transgressors. Because, you know, we had created a kind of utopian society and we weren't going to stand for it if a Daily Mail columnist wrote something homophobic and so on. And to this day, I know I'm giving a big, long essay here, I apologise, but I'll get to the end of this very quickly. To this day, that kind of thing still happens and that's great, but something else has happened, you know, as a result of that, which is this, you know, desire to be constantly on the lookout for people who aren't like us that we can get. And it happens, yeah, every single day. And I would say that this sort of dogmatic, polemical attitude has sprung out from Twitter and social media into mainstream politics. And it's one of the reasons why Donald Trump is now the head of the Republican Party. I think it explains to an extent, I mean, to an extent, the rise of ISIS. It's this milieu is affecting, the world.
Yeah, but it's also been a force for good as well. I mean, if you think about the Arab Spring, that was in many ways a phenomenon of social media. I mean, it played a big part, didn't it?
Right. So I was going to say, well, my friend, the documentary maker Adam Curtis, would say that the Arab Spring, you know, people cite the Arab Spring as being something positive about social media. But actually, you know, as soon as the Arab Spring happened, nobody knew what to do. and all the old conservative oligarchs took over again.
Yeah, that's very true. So actually,
the Arab Spring wasn't. But you know, you see positive things in other places. I mean, yeah. You know, the outpouring of you know, we're talking on the day after the MP Joe Cox was killed, and you know, the outpouring of grief and people trying to make sense of it and people trying to springboard that into a better world. And starting up a fund. And, you know, the same thing happened after the Orlando shootings next week. You know, wonderful things do happen on social media.
Sure, yeah. Okay, well, could you maybe then just give us a couple of examples where it did go badly wrong, where people got very hurt?
Okay, I mean, there was one yesterday. I mean, you know, I write about a number in my book, which happened a year or two ago. Things like Justine Sa- I mean, I suppose the one that's become the most famous one, partly because of a book an extract from my book in the New York Times, was about Justine Sacco, who tweeted, "Going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white." Trying to make this kind of South Park liberal joke, mocking her privilege, and then got on a plane, fell asleep, and by the time she woke up, her life was you know, never the same again. She was fired from her job. And so on. One happened yesterday. I've got to say, this one annoyed me so much, and I almost sort of fell victim, you know, to the sort of anger that I'm, you know, that I'm criticising in my book. And it was a woman. Let me just find the tweet. You know that Orlando's had a terrible week. You know, there was the shooting at the Pulse nightclub, but there was the murder of the singer from The Voice, and then this little baby, you know, this kid was staying at the Grand Floridian at the Disney World, and an alligator attacked the kid and killed the kid. And a writer, somebody on Twitter wrote, "I'm so finished with the white men's entitlement lately that I'm really not sad about a two-year-old being eaten by a gator because his daddy ignored signs." So that's what she tweeted. Then she added, you really think there are no fucking consequences to anything? A goddamn sign told you to stay out of water in Florida. Fuck a sign. And then somebody summed up my feelings by tweeting at her, "Tell me more about how a two-year-old deserves to die for his race and gender. I want to be progressive like you." So, I mean, my initial thought reading that was, you know, this is exactly what I'm talking about. You know, the phrase misuse of privilege, you know, white privilege, white male entitlement, all of this stuff, whilst, of course, rooted in an understanding of the disparities of society, has become a kind of free pass to tear apart anybody that you want to. And that reached a real nadir when this woman says, you know, basically she doesn't care about a two-year-old kid dying because her father was a white man. Yeah. She, by the way, was a white woman.
Yeah.
And a lawyer, apparently. So when I first read that thing, I thought, you know, this is exactly what I've been getting so angry about the last year, which is, you know, the fact that misuse of privilege has become this kind of free pass to just ruin anybody that we want. But then, of course, what happened to this woman was that she was, I mean, it was, you know, incredibly stupid and offensive and anger-inducing tweet, but she was then just torn to shreds. I believe she's lost her job. She was subjected to, you know, such an onslaught of misogynistic and, you know, tweets from men's rights activists and anti-SJWs, as they're called, social justice warriors, as people call them, that she then had to delete her Twitter account and, you know, apparently has gone into hiding. So there you have these two extreme sets of people tearing each other apart, and that's the kind of dominant, you know, the sort of dominant milieu these days.
Yeah, yeah. To what degree do you think the sort of relative disembodied nature of social media plays a part in allowing us to, you know, to somehow switch off our empathy?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, certainly the snowflake doesn't need to feel responsible for the avalanche. And, you know, the drone strike operator doesn't need to think of the village that they've just blown up. But I think the other reason is it's all about trying to be good people. You know, she tweeted the fact that she didn't care about the two-year-old dying because the father was an entitled man, and was her trying to be a good person. You know, it was her trying to show, I mean, I don't need to explain, it's obvious what, you know, what she was trying to say. And then the people who tore her apart thought that they were good people. You know, what I've found like over and over again this past year in this exhausting way is that the desire to be a good, kind, ethical, compassionate person is what's compelling, you know, this, you know, huge amount of cruelty.
Yeah, it's like that saying, nobody does evil for evil's sake.
Yeah, well, in fact, the psychiatrist or psychologist Albert Bandura has just brought out a book called Moral Disengagement, and one of his points, which is what I sort of noticed myself when I was writing So You've Been Publicly Shamed, is that violence is fiercer when it's done in the name of morality.
Yeah.
You know, it's worse. You know, it's worse when it's done in the name of morality.
No, I agree with that. I think there's an Italian philosopher, called Gianni Vattimo, he said that alongside every truth lies the shadow of violence. You know, if you're a crusader, then you've got to have unbelievers or people in the wrong as well.
Right, yeah, absolutely. And it's exhausting, and I find it like truly, and I'm sure you do too, because of what your society is about. I find it really worrying because this isn't just about social media. I remember one of the very first talks I gave for So You've Been Publicly Shamed was in Santa Cruz, and there was an elderly lady sitting in the front row who was pointedly shaking her head in disagreement with everything that I was saying during my talk. And then when it came to the Q&A, she immediately put her hand up, and so I said, "Yeah," and she said something along the lines of, if you're, you know, who cares? You know, if you're going to play with the Twitter toy, then it's your fault if you get burned, because my story was about a Twitter shaming.
Yeah.
But I think I hope I'm not being too polemical or dogmatic myself, but I think what the last sort of year or so has really taught us is that this is not just about social media anymore. You know, Donald Trump is the Twitter candidate.
Mm-hmm.
You could even argue that the fact that the left has got more, I mean, I happen to be a fan of Jeremy Corbyn, but or, you know, to an extent anyway, but, you know, you could argue that the fact that the left has got Jeremy Corbyn as its leader again is like a sort of result of this. And, you know, you could argue that the Orlando shooting was influenced by this, and ISIS was influenced by this, and, you know, we're living in these, it's almost like this sort of pre-Renaissance times.
So would you say that social media is to an extent this sort of huge confirmation bias generator?
Yes, because it's a kind of mutual approval machine. You know, we surround ourselves with people who feel the same way that we do, and we approve each other. And yeah, what comes out of this is this kind of vast amount of confirmation bias. I mean, you know, when you stop and think, it's ridiculous. Justine Sacco's tweet, nobody knew anything about Justine Sacco except for what she looked like, which was a blonde white woman who looks like she enjoys going to parties in New York. And then this one tweet, which was, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. And, you know, from these fragments of information, people, via confirmation bias, drew this entire portrait of this person that just wasn't true, which, you know, ended up with people being convinced as she was asleep on the plane that her father was the South African mining billionaire Desmond Sacco, I thought that was true about her right up until I met her in a bar a couple of weeks later, and I asked her about her billionaire father, and she looked at me like I was nuts and said, my father's a carpet salesman. Confirmation bias. I've got a joke in the book where I say that, you know, ever since I first learned about confirmation bias, I've been seeing it everywhere.
that got a belly laugh out of me, that, I remember.
That's my favourite psychology joke. Confirmation bias is rife. And a whole bunch of things are rife. You know, I think it's this, you know, moral violence and this sort of amateur sleuthness, this idea that we can work out who somebody is on the basis of this tiny information, and we're always lurching towards an extreme. That person is an incredible hero, or that person is a terrible villain. And there are those things in the world, but they're pretty rare, you know. Yeah. Most of us are in the middle.
Yeah, and in relation to cognitive biases, you also cite several examples of the book how people sort of justify their actions via cognitive dissonance. Now, you were just talking about Justin Sackle, the guy that actually posted it out to a much wider audience. He came out with a phrase to reduce his dissonance. Could you maybe expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, so cognitive dissonance, it wasn't really something that I understood. I didn't really know what it was until I started researching this book. But, yeah. You know, it's the idea that we find it difficult to have two opposing points of view in our heads at the same time. And so, you know, that's a kind of mentally painful thing. And so we try and find a way to simplify. We try and find a way to kind of shove one of these points of view out of our minds. That's basically cognitive dissonance, yeah. Right? The guy who started the onslaught against Justine Sacco, he was a Gawker journalist called Sam Biddle, and he said to me, I'm sure she's fine. I'm sure she's fine now, or if not now, soon. She'll be fine. And she wasn't fine. She was crushed. And it's because, you know, we see ourselves as good, ethical, kind people. That's what motivates us. Yet we are harming people. We're really hurting people. You know, people kill themselves. I mean, nobody ever writes about the people who kill. There's a surprisingly small amount of stuff written about the people who kill themselves because of social media shamings.
Sure.
And I think it's part of the same thing. It's because we want to see ourselves as good people. We can't handle the fact that we're leaving, you know, corpses in our wake. And so we just don't think about it. We just pretend that they're fine. Or if we can't pretend that they're fine, we do the next best thing, which is to say, oh, well, they're psychopaths, they're sociopaths. Yeah. You know, we use dehumanizing phrases. I know of a number of people who've killed themselves because of, you know, either unfair or partly fair social media shamings. And there's almost nothing written about these people.
That's so sad.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, well, let's have a look about maybe a bit more positive side. Following a comment from another someone that was shamed, a guy called Jonah Lehrer, you started looking for people who had found a way out of shame. What did you find?
Yeah. Well, actually, I was going to answer that in a different way.
Oh, go for it.
Okay, well, last night I saw this documentary about Anthony Weiner, the New York mayoral candidate who was dumb for basically sexting people. And it was so interesting watching this documentary because his point, he was taking this sort of French perspective that, you know, my flawed personal life has got absolutely nothing to do with my politics and and he's a good liberal progressive politician. I felt the documentary made a kind of compelling case for that. I met people who, I think one of the main things to do, and Anthony Weiner did this and Max Mosley did this and maybe in this way Donald Trump does this even, is, narrow, you know, our shameworthiness lies in the space between who we are and how we present ourselves to the world. And if that is a cavernous space, then you're kind of screwed. But if you narrow that space to nothing, it makes you far less shameworthy. So that means admitting it. Yeah, that, you know, certainly don't lie about your transgression. It means admitting it. It means kind of making self-deprecating jokes about it. So with Max Mosley, for instance, you know, who was caught in what the News of the World called a sick Nazi orgy, when it wasn't a Nazi orgy, it was like a kind of German-tinged orgy. Yeah. Max's point was, you know, everybody knows when it comes to sex, people do and think and say strange things. So I'm not the idiot. You're the idiot for pretending to yourself that that's not true about us.
Yeah. Very powerful. And so he, in a sense, refused to be shamed.
And, you know, that's problematic in itself. I mean, I happen to really like Max Mosley. I tend to always like people who give me access into their lives. It's a bit, I'm a bit biased that way. But it's not always good, of course. I mean, a kind of, you know, a sort of inability to feel shame is not necessarily a good characteristic, especially if you're Donald Trump. And,
But I suppose it depends on the conditions and circumstances. And that, in that situation, it was appropriate.
Yeah, I certainly think it was appropriate with Max Mosley. I mean, a ridiculous kind of prurience, you know, that the mainstream media, it's all, you know, it's a money-making game for people. I mean, I think if, you know, if you're in a consensual sex scandal, yes, if you can find a way to not let them get you through it, then all the better.
Yeah. Okay, so what do you think would happen if we sort of try to give up of the idea of shaming completely? Is there a corner of the justice system that's trying this out?
There are. I mean, where I'm standing now, I can see across the Hudson River to New Jersey, and I spent some time in a prison in New Jersey where they were trying just that. They were trying this kind of radical de-shaming stuff. It's literally just a room, a big room, where the prisoners, maybe sort of 30 or 40 prisoners, you know, women on one side, men on the other, two separate rooms. They stay in dorms, and they just talk respectfully to each other, and it's all about kind of respect. It's all about, you know, self-esteem and respect. And then, you know, what tends to happen when those people are let out of prison and go out into the world, it gives them a real head start. Sort of de-shaming gives people a head start. So I was following that, and from time to time that's tried in prisons, I think in Britain and America. The problem is that there's such a kind of prejudice against programs like that, because, you know, a lot of people's proclivity is to be sort of tough on criminals. I remember one prison officer saying to me, they don't even want, you know, they don't even want them to have weights because they don't want them getting strong in there.
Wow.
So that's a kind of attitude. But in Britain too, you know, this sort of draconian no forgiveness, no reentry stuff that you sometimes hear happening in American prisons, you know, academically we think that stuff's terrible. Like, who would act like that? And then when we're shaming somebody on Twitter, we have exactly the same attitude. You know, this person should never be allowed another job. Justine Sacker got a job a year after her shaming. And when Twitter found out, they tried to get her fired all over again.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that kind of draconian, hanging judge type attitude, you know, has become prevalent on the left.
Yeah.
I mean, was it always? I mean, I like to think of the left. I mean, I suppose there was always like an element of it, but I don't know. It feels like it's kind of taking over.
It's hard to tell, isn't it? I mean, there's always been public shaming. I mean, you used to have the stocks at one stage, didn't you? And then, you know, there was shaming in the 30s, if you know, if you were a single mother. But there's something about social media that seems to have ratcheted it up. But again, you know, maybe we always think things were better in the past. There's a sort of bias going on there as well, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe. But there's a sort of what Bret Easton Ellis would call a sentimental narrative, that, you know, public shaming is a kind of appropriate recourse for marginalised people because, you know, they've got no voice in any other way.
Yeah.
And you can certainly see how that's true when it comes to some kind of rape cases, for instance.
Okay.
But, you know, historically, rape victims have been treated terribly in the official mainstream justice system. And a lot of feminists believe, you know, with some justification, of course, that the way to combat that is to publicly shame rapists on social media.
Yeah.
And of course, that's in many ways compelling. But it's wrong to think that that doesn't come with its own problems, because it you know, it massively does.
Sure, yeah. Okay, at the end of the book, at least the hard copy version, which I read, you wondered whether because you'd expressed the unpopular belief that people like Justine Sacco are not monsters, you also might be subject to a tidal wave of abuse yourself. Now, this, to a large extent, has actually happened, hasn't it? Could you give us a bit of a flavour of that and how it's affected you? And are any, perhaps any lessons that can be drawn from your own experience that may be useful for, you know, for other people when dealing with online offence?
Well, it did happen quite a lot after the piece came out. I mean, I tend to think about the kind of ridiculous things that happen, both because it's funny, but also, and also because it kind of, when somebody attacks me in a ridiculous way, and I recount that story to people, it makes me look good. So, you know, at first people were kind of tweeting things like, this all started with Justine Sacco, you know, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS, just kidding, I'm white. So eventually people started, you know what was really interesting actually, people just didn't want to handle the fact that they made a mistake with Justine, which they really did. You know, yeah. She wasn't intending to be racist. She was asleep on a plane and unable to defend herself. You know, it was incredibly injudicial. But, and some people were like, oh my God, you know, I can't believe what we did. But most, you know, but then there were other people that were like, well, John Ronson must be a racist. And then, so that's kind of how it started. Yeah. I remember somebody tweeted, well, I tweeted, by the way, that Justine Sacco extracts in the New York Times isn't a standalone article. It's a extract from a book. And somebody tweeted, oh, now Ronson saying it's an extract from a book. Like, what's that mean? It was always an extract from a book. And then somebody wrote, why isn't John Ronson applying to any of us? And somebody else wrote, because John Ronson only applies to men.
Oh, wow.
But then it escalated and escalated. And a false narrative began to form, which was that my book didn't understand gender differences, didn't understand that women have it worse than men, which is just not true. I mean, it was incredibly frustrating to me, to the extent that my wife has basically banned me from talking about it, to see things written about my book that weren't true. And every so often, the other day, you know, it's a year and a half later now, and it's still going on. The other day, a Pulitzer Prize winning critic was slagging off my book and was saying things about the book that weren't true. So I emailed him. I found his email address online, and I emailed him and said, you know, I've got to ask, have you read the book? And he emailed back, I've been meaning to.
Right.
And this was a critic who won a Pulitzer Prize. But, you know, this is how kind of things are now, which is that a sort of, you know, sentimental false narrative about a story is enough. Like, you don't need to actually read the book. So that kind of goes on to this day. One negative effect I think it had on me was that I became, by the way, I should say in the paperback of So You've Been Publicly Shamed, I've written this new long 10,000 word chapter that talks about everything that happened after the hardback came out.
Okay.
One thing that I noticed happening to me was that I became like the person who would pipe up every time there was a unfair shaming and like defend the shamee. So I became like a bit of a caricature, I suppose. It was like a hardening of positions, you know, which is what I'm against. Yeah, I found myself doing it.
Yeah, well, I imagine that was very understandable given the circumstances. But have you managed to sort of take a step back a bit now, or are you?
Well, I mean, yeah, to an extent. Although when I see people saying things about the book that aren't true, sometimes I kind of feel the need to tell them to, you know, please read the book.
Yeah, sure.
Because people who read the book, you know that the book is a responsible book. It's only people who haven't read the book who you know, have come to sort of untrue conclusions about it. I was definitely kind of, you know, damaged by this kind of small group of social justice people on the left who decided to try and kind of get the book. And I think it did do a bit of damage. But luckily, only a limited amount, because there was no substance to it, because anybody who then went and read the book could see that those accusations weren't true.
Yeah.
But that's never happened to me before. Like, my other books were more, they weren't like kind of explosions in this way. Yeah. You know, my other books were just sort of, people just liked them by and large. I remember my publisher sending me a card at Christmas saying, just before the book came out, saying, you know, get some rest. Things are about to get bumpy. And I emailed him back to say, what are you talking about? And he emailed back to say, well, some people are going to hate the book. And I remember thinking, oh, nobody's going to hate the book. How could they? I'm right. It turns out that being right isn't enough necessarily. When ideology is more important. I mean, this is the thing. It's like, you know, we're living in very ideological times.
Yeah.
And when people care more about, you know, an overarching ideology than they do about people or facts or nuance, you know, we're fucked.
Yeah.
And that's where we are now. Yeah.
Well, this brings me very appropriately to my last question about, you know, you talk about sort of fixed ideologies. The middle way, as we understand it, is the idea that we make better judgments by avoiding fixed or dogmatic beliefs about things, whether those beliefs are positive or negative. That then throws us back onto experience. So we're left in this sort of messy, it's a word that you use quite often, messy, uncertain middle. But it's arguably in this messy, uncertain middle that we actually can start to get to grips more adequately with the phenomena that we encounter, you know.
By the way, the dogs have all started barking.
It's all right.
I agree with you. I mean, so where are we going to go with it? Because I agree with everything that you just said.
Yeah, but I was just going to say, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
I think it's kind of critical to what we've been talking about. I understand like why ideology can be really important.
Yeah.
You know, huge, great changes have happened in my lifetime. You know, the world is a lot less homophobic than it was, and I think the world is a lot less racist than it was.
Definitely.
And we have, you know, we have ideology to thank for that to a large extent. I mean, I live in New York City, which is this kind of, you know, incredible multicultural place, you know, which really works. You know, it really works. I'm incredibly proud of this city that I live in. For those reasons. So I totally see the value of ideology. I remember last Christmas I was with Owen Jones and he was like, you know, ideology should be messy and people, I'm sort of paraphrasing him, but it's like, you know, we should be awkward and difficult to make the world a better place. And I really do get that. But I think what's happening at the moment is that there's such a kind of... you know, people have become so ideological, that's become like such a kind of dominant viewpoint, that something's got lost. And what's got lost is humanism. It's understanding the kind of vagaries of human beings, the kind of complicated, messy, unsatisfying, you know, grey areas, you know, that human beings are. And I really feel that the pendulum has swung, you know, too far towards ideology and too far away from humanism.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess that this most recent book was my attempt to sort of try and swing the pendulum back a little bit.
Well, I think you've helped in that regard. Despite the flack that you've received, I think it's a really valuable work. And I know there's many people in our society that have appreciated it too. So, I think it's great you got it out there. And as I said, I don't know how brave you were at the beginning. Looking back in hindsight.
Well, I remember, you know what? I remember in the midst of all of this, somebody tweeted me something angry. And I tweeted back and said, you know what, journalism shouldn't be a popularity contest. And you know, he kind of said, well, you know, I'm not saying journalism should be a popularity contest. But that's the thing. It's like, you know, if you're a journalist, it shouldn't be all about being liked.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, on that note, John, it's been a real pleasure talking to you. And thank you very much for giving up your time this evening. And hope you enjoy your takeaway.
Thank you. It's I'm looking forward to it. It's just arrived.
All right. All right, then.
Okay, cool. Take it easy.
Bye now.
Okay, bye, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.